This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon and welcome to Live and Learn on the Bigger Picture. I'm PJ Thumb and I'm a historian from the University of Oxford. And this is the history of Singapore. Episode 26, The Lion of Singapore. When we last met, a new age had just dawned in Singapore. It was April 1955. David Marshall had just been elected Chief Minister. Singapore had a new constitution with a limited form of self-government designed to give locals responsibility, but without any real power. The money and the guns, the portfolios addressing security and finance, remained in the hands of the British, and the governor still had a final veto. In a previous episode, we explored how this arrangement led to a rise in associational democracy. If the Legislative Assembly didn't have any actual power, then Singapore's people would seek to make gains outside of the formal political process through what we today might think of as civil society. Everything from petitions and mass mobilization, so basically what we do today using Twitter and Facebook, to boycotts and strikes. These were the weapons of the weak against the British Empire. By standing together, they were able to resist the tyranny of an authoritarian government and fight for positive change. Before April 1955, of course, such protests would have been met by overwhelming force. Using the emergency regulations, the British crushed any attempt to protest. They would send in the police and arrest the organisers, claiming that they were all communists. If a protest broke out, the police would be sent in with instructions to break it up. No matter how legitimate the grievance, no matter how unfair the situation was to the people of Singapore, the police would be sent in and dissenters would be arrested, dissenters would be thrown in jail, and the whole thing would be crushed. So protest and dissent was not permitted. And the British were acting based on their own agenda, which was the policy set by London and which was decolonization. They needed to sort out the colony, get it ready for independence, and they had to do it soon. The forces of history were already in motion. It was already beyond their control. The alarm clock of history could ring at any time, waking them up from the empire, heralding the end of their influence in Singapore. They had no idea when that might happen. So they needed to sort things out now, crack down now while they still had an excuse, and get Singapore turned into a reliable post-independence ally now. But following the April 1955 elections, the people of Singapore found that space for protest had increased, and correspondingly, the British found that their own scope for repression had significantly decreased. And the difference was, well, it was just one man. It's not often that one man can change the course of a country. But David Saul Marshall was that man. That Singapore is as democratic as it is today, that it's as clean and corruption-free as it is today, that the government has to face the people in meet the people sessions, that it still has to adhere to a rhetoric of accountability, the vestiges of our democracy, our expectations of our politicians. A lot of that is due to the first man to hold the office of Chief Minister, the first locally born man to ever run our government. He is the man who defined how Singapore government should be run, because there was no one before him. He had the honour of creating the practices that the expectations and the practices of that office. And he is the man who imbued the office with morality and responsibility. He is the man who created the idea that the person who occupies that office is a servant of the people. So Marshall made an impact from the moment he got into office. There was very little he could do because of how the constitution was set up, but there was a lot that he could not do. Even if he couldn't change British policy, he could at least make sure that the laws were enforced fairly, that the police weren't sent out to oppress people, that the government treated people fairly, that they treated people like human beings instead of economic digits and slaves. He could represent the view of Singapore's people in the Legislative Assembly and set the agenda for the government so that it looked at policies which benefited the poor, the voiceless, the oppressed. It is in the practice of power that Marshall truly distinguishes himself. He does not take power and treat it like a tool to be used to achieve some sort of aim. He does not act like he is better than us, even though he was clearly a very, very smart and courageous and principled man. He takes power and he treats it like a responsibility. He is a servant, not a ruler. A man of the people, not someone who lords it over them. And just this attitude alone is a massive, massive change from the colonial government, which of course acted like they owned us. And for all intents and purposes, they did. So if Lee Kuan Yew is responsible for the economic success of Singapore, the muscles of our body corporate, then David Marshall is responsible for the moral success of Singapore, our spirituality, the heart and soul of our body corporate. Singapore is a success today, no less because of the efforts of David Marshall than it is of Lee Kuan Yew. The problem is that while it is easy to measure economic success by using statistics and looking at the gleaming buildings around us, how do you measure spiritual success? How do you measure moral success? How do you measure the success of someone whose main act was really to set expectations so high that his successors had to follow them? How do you measure the success of a man who set the standard for morality, who defined an office in such a way that no prime minister ever since has ever been able to escape his shadow? How do you evaluate the only man who ever resigned the office of leader of government on principle, who resigned because he failed to keep his election promises? Well, over the next few weeks, I'm going to try to explain the greatness of David Marshall and how his praxis of power defined the office and still defines it today. Who was David Marshall? Well, David Saul Marshall was born in Singapore in 1908 into a Baghdadi Jewish family based in Singapore. It's important to remember that the Jewish people were also an oppressed subject people in Singapore. The Singaporean Jewish community was chiefly comprised of Jews from Baghdad. Marshall was an Asian, not a white man, from perhaps the smallest and most distinct community in Singapore. And he was treated as such. He was very, very keenly conscious of being a distinct lower class person from a very young age. He was discriminated against for his ethnicity, for his culture, for his religion, and until they anglicized it, for his name. When Marshall was 6, his family were visiting their relatives in Baghdad in 1914, and World War I broke out. The Ottoman Empire and the British were on opposing sides, and the Marshalls were travelling on British passports. His family were detained and interned. So his first experience of indefinite detention without trial was at 6 years old. Fortunately, the Ottoman administration in Baghdad was weak and corrupt, and so they were able to make life easier for themselves by bribing the officials. In 1917, the British captured Baghdad, allowing the Marshalls to return home to Singapore, finally. David was 9 years old, but had not been to school and could only speak Hebrew and Arabic. He had a lot of catching up to do. He initially went to CHIJ, which admitted boys in kindergarten and lower primary. But on his very first day, another cheeky classmate came up to him and said, "Jowdy Jew, brush my shoe, bring it back at 2:30. David could barely speak English, but he knew when he was being made fun of and promptly punched the other kid in the face. As we'll see, this wasn't the last time that David would experience anti-Semitism, nor the last time he would strongly and forcefully respond. The next year, 1918, David moved to St. Joseph's Institution. He was a bright student and skipped a grade to go into Standard 2. But in 1919, he was unable to attend school because of Rosh Hashanah, one of the holiest Jewish days. He had to go to the synagogue, so he couldn't go to school. It's like asking a Muslim to go to school or to work on Hari Raya Haji, or a Christian on Good Friday, or a Hindu on Thai Pusam. Marshall went to the synagogue instead of school on a holy day and so was expelled. He asked his father to protest to the director of education, but his father laughed and said, "You want me to appeal? From one white man to another white man? He won't even see me." and David learnt another harsh lesson about the place of Jews in white society. And so David now found himself at St. Andrews. And the next year, 1920, an American classmate started taunting a Chinese classmate with the phrase, "Ching Ching Chinaman." Marshall, of course, promptly punched the American kid. And to his anger, for this act, he was scolded by the principal of St. Andrews, the Reverend Lee. Not because he had resorted to violence, but because, the Reverend Lee said, the good Lord created people unequally, that certain people were better than others. Lee asked Marshall, "Would you marry a Malay or a Chinese or Indian?" And Marshall said, "Oh, why not, sir?" And for this response, Marshall was caned. Marshall later recalled, and I quote, "I was angry that this man of God, this man whose religion taught him that humanity are all brothers in the fatherhood of God, this man should say to me, 'The Chinese, the Malays, and the Indians are subhumans whom I could not marry.' I was so angry. I was furious. Just because he was a decent man, how could he believe these things?" But that was the atmosphere of the day. Marshall was 12 years old. After graduating from St. Andrews, Marshall went on to Raffles Institution and was one of, or indeed was the top pupil there. But his stay was cut short by ill health. He had suffered malaria when younger, and now he contracted tuberculosis. This was before the discovery of the antibiotic streptomycin in 1943, and so back then the recommended cure was to go away to a sanatorium. Switzerland was supposed to have the best sanatoria, so his father scraped together the money to send David to Switzerland. And it was on the ship to Switzerland, recalls David, where he had a sudden realization that would change his life. He later recalled, and I quote, "When I was a child, I had believed that God was white and the British were his special agents. I thought that as Asians, it was our privilege to eat off the crumbs of their table. But while on board a ship to Switzerland, I suddenly came across the concept that all men are equal. It's not the never-never in heaven, but here on earth today." That was an explosive introduction to a different form of life. Marshall had been regarded as the top candidate for the Queen's Scholarship in 1925, but missed the examination because of his illness. So after graduating from school, David went to work and saved money for his university education. Like most Singaporeans, his family was badly affected by the Great Depression of the 1930s. Bills went unpaid, and doctors would not treat his family when they became ill because they owed over $400 to the doctors. But Marshall kept working and kept learning at the same time, burning a candle at both ends. Like many of his future colleagues in the anti-colonial movement, Marshall started a community magazine to try and revitalize his community and inject it with new ideas and greater dynamism. It was called Israelite, as in Israel, L-I-G-H-T. Lovely pun. By 1934, after nearly 10 years of working, Marshall had saved enough money to go to London and study law at the University of London. In London, he would again experience much discrimination as a Jew and an Asian and a colonial subject, but he persevered and got honours in his exams. He was called to the bar at the Middle Temple in 1937. He then returned to Singapore, the first Jewish lawyer in Singapore. But he continued to face discrimination from his colleagues who were mostly European and who looked down upon this Jewish upstart. In 1938, it was the Munich crisis, fomented by the German invasion of Czechoslovakia, that led Marshall to sign up with the Singapore Volunteer Corps. Back then, of course, Singapore was chiefly protected by the British Army and Navy. But patriotic locals like David Marshall, who wanted to defend their country in the event of an invasion, could sign up with the Volunteer Corps. This then would give you part-time training in the evenings and on weekend. The Volunteer Corps dated from 1854, when the European community had created it as an internal security force. It was formalized by the Indian government in 1857, went through several reorganizations, and by 1938, Singapore had two battalions made of six companies. Naturally, they were organized on racial lines. Companies A and B were European. Company C was Scottish. Company D was Eurasian. Company E was Chinese, and Company F was Malay. So when Marshall showed up, the administrators could not figure out where to put the one Jewish guy. They eventually decided on Company D, the Eurasian company, and Marshall got really annoyed because of the stupidity of it all, but also because he was not Eurasian, he was Asian, and proud of it. There was no European in him. But they couldn't put him with the Chinese, or the Malays, or the Scottish. And Company A were the pure-blood British and Western European snobs and wouldn't take him. So finally they assigned him to Company B, which comprised the second-class Europeans, the Poles, the Czechs, the Yugoslavs, and other odds and ends who didn't fit anywhere else. And I'd like to say Marshall thrived, but by all accounts he was, let's say, not a natural soldier. He worked very hard, but Marshall just wasn't the soldier type. Later, of course, there was another problem when they received the allowance. The Europeans in the volunteer corps received $1.04 a day in allowance. But Asians received half of that, 52 cents. And Marshall, of course, had declared himself an Asian and proud of it. And so, in Company B, he alone received only 52 cents, while everyone else in his company received $1.04. Angered by this discrimination, he refused to take his allowance and demanded to see the general. For his insolence, he was confined to barracks all weekend. Late on Sunday, the grumpy sergeant major came to him and said, "You are released from confinement. Here is your $1.04. For a lawyer earning maybe upwards of $750 a month, $1.04 was small change. But of course, for David Marshall, it was never about the money. In 1941, the Japanese invaded Malaya, and Marshall fought valiantly in defense of his country, chiefly as a runner, carrying messages. As I mentioned, he wasn't very good as a soldier. But we all know what happened next. Following the British surrender of Singapore to the Japanese in 1942, Marshall became a prisoner of war. He was later sent to the Hokkaido coal mines, where he nearly died. He was 5'11½" or over 180 cm tall, but weighed just 53 kilos by the end of his time in Hokkaido. Reflecting later on his experience as a prisoner, he recalled being absolutely shocked by the inhumanity of the Japanese. It was beyond anything he had encountered from the British. His experience taught him the depths of human depravity. He later recalled that, quote, "Japanese cruelty was cold-blooded, permanent and eternal. Man's inhumanity to man, in fact, in real life, made its presence really known to me when I became a prisoner and saw it in action. Of course I had known cruelty before, but widespread, long-term, cold-blooded, permanent cruelty I've never experienced before, not even from the British imperialists, no matter how arrogant they were. That was a major shock. The feeling that here were human beings who were not on the same wavelength as me at all, who were not even human from my point of view." Unquote. But the experience also gave him courage. In the camps, he also saw the best of human behavior, where he could see what men were made of. And his determination to survive brought out the best in himself. Thinking back, David recalled, quote, "Perhaps I learnt most of all the frailty of human beings, the absurdity of status symbols, of carrying a captain's star or major's crown, and turning out to be a long streak of piss. Whereas the cook, who was a lance corporal, turned out to be a really worthwhile human being. I learned to survive." Unquote. When we return, more about the life of David Marshall, the Lion of Singapore. BFM 89.9. Good afternoon, this is Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture, and I'm PJ Thumb. If you've just joined us, welcome to this week's episode of The History of Singapore, The Lion of Singapore. After the Japanese occupation, David Marshall returned to Singapore and helped pick up the pieces. He returned to his old law firm, Allen & Gledhill, and helped rebuild it. He also helped rebuild the Jewish community, which had been severely hit by the war. It had reached a peak of 2,000 people before the war, but between the consistent discrimination they faced in Malaya, the internment and death from the war, and the better prospects abroad, many of them didn't bother coming back. The community was down to just around 150 members. Marshall helped start the Jewish Welfare Association and was its first president. In 1949, the association was named the Jewish Welfare Board and it continues to be active today. The board raised funds for the poor, built the first all folks home for the poor, infirm and aged members of the community, and recruited a rabbi for Singapore, Rabbi Jacob Shababo, himself a fascinating and somewhat controversial figure. Marshall also fought for the rights of former prisoners of war, and especially Asian prisoners of war. European prisoners of war had been compensated for their suffering and their loss of income, but not Asians. And Marshall fought for equal treatment. You see, in July 1946, the Secretary of State for the colonies stated that the British government was not liable to pay any civil claims made by Malayan ex-volunteers. Why? Because the Malayan government had ceased to exist with the fall of Singapore. Yet, at the same time, the British compensated European ex-volunteers. This utter ridiculous reasoning and the hypocrisy of the discrimination infuriated Marshall. It made a mockery of all the fighting and suffering that Asians had gone through for Malaya. It was blatant discrimination. The War Prisoners Singapore Association was formed to fight for the rights of Singapore's prisoners of war. The governor promised to examine the matter thoroughly. But as we know from our long experience with government in Singapore, that phrase generally means they're just going to sit on it forever and not do anything. And of course, they didn't. Some things never change. Marshall sharply commented, quote, "I must be forgiven if sometimes I gather the impression that there is no government in this colony, only a bureaucracy of lazy clerks." Unquote. This was the biggest but not the only issue facing the former prisoners of war. In general, the former POW struggled with a lack of housing and poverty and medical conditions brought on by their suffering in the war. They had no property and no income and the local government refused to help them. Marshall fought valiantly on their behalf, but to no avail. On this and on a wide range of other issues, Marshall lobbied the government, using his position, his knowledge, his expertise, seeking to make the voice of the people heard. But time and time again, the colonial government simply ignored him. But this did mean that Marshall was increasingly a public figure. He was increasingly a community leader, not just among the Jewish community, but among all Singaporeans. Marshall was not interested in politics, but by the late 1940s, Marshall had emerged as a leader, an organizer, someone who was willing to take on the government, someone who was willing to help people solve their problems. He was not primarily aiming at politics, but simply was just concerned with helping society at the ground level. His wartime experience and his innate kindness and generosity had ignited in him a deep desire to serve humanity. Nor was he strategic about which causes he involved himself in, but rather just followed what came naturally, what he had expertise in, what he was concerned with himself. He was a Jew, a prisoner of war, a middle-class professional, and so it was the causes associated with these communities with which he found himself working on. But of course, as he learned, and as we've seen throughout this series, you had to get involved in politics if you wanted change. Otherwise, the governor could simply ignore him and other civil society actors. And so in 1949, David Marshall joined the Progressive Party. As we've discussed in a previous episode, the Progressive Party was the chosen party of the British, comprised of English-speaking middle-class professionals whom the British wanted to encourage as a new pro-British governing class, a pro-British elite to which the British could hand over power reliably. Throughout the emergency, left-wing and genuinely anti-colonial parties were forcefully suppressed and not allowed to function. The Progressive Party was the only party available. So Marshall joined, but he was not comfortable with its conservative politics. At the same time, Marshall could accept that they had certain beliefs. What he disliked more was their hypocrisy, when they took positions not on principle, but for political gain. And this issue would be a recurring issue throughout his political career. Marshall would never be a natural politician, never comfortable with compromise. Marshall would adhere to principle, to do what he thought was right, rather than what was probably more politically astute. And most of all, what Marshall disliked about the Progressive Party was their elitism. He later recalled, quote, "Their attitude was a singular one that we are the elite and we've got to be careful of this rabble, the China-born Chinese, the coolie with the one trouser up one leg. We have got to protect our interests and this is Singapore. These others are all immigrants, non-citizens. They don't really belong to Singapore. They're the immigrants, the non-citizens. We are Singapore." It was a very stultifying atmosphere and progressively I got very tired of it. Unquote. So Marshall never intended to play a central role in politics, but politics came calling for him. The Singapore Labour Party was the chief opposition to the Progressive Party, but it was comprised of a huge number of different left-wing factions united only by their opposition to the colonial government. And so it split apart in 1951. In 1953, the faction led by Francis Thomas and Lim Yew Hock invited David in to help write their constitution, and eventually they asked him to join them. David thought, oh, okay, he'd also bring in his friend S. Rajaratnam, and Rajaratnam's friends Goh Keng Swee, Kenny Byrne, Toh Chin Chye, and Lee Kuan Yew. So all of them met in Lee's home in Oxley Road in January 1954. But as David wrote in his diary that day, the meeting left a quote-unquote bitter taste. Fundamentally, they were apart in matters of principle and attitude. Marshall focused on principles, what was right and wrong. Lee on power, what worked and didn't work. Marshall saw Lee as disgustingly amoral. Lee saw Marshall as hopelessly idealistic. And most of all, Marshall and Thomas recalled, they could not stand how Lee looked down upon them. The elitist arrogance of the man. And years later, Lee confirmed this in his own autobiography, where he wrote very condescendingly about David Marshall and Francis Thomas. And so, all of them could not work together. They parted ways. Marshall was left with a coalition of pro-labour interests, a haphazard group of men brought together by a common cause of anti-colonialism. As he was the most neutral of the prominent members of the coalition, David Marshall was asked to be the unifying leader by Francis Thomas and others. And with great reluctance, Marshall agreed. And so Marshall found himself leading a coalition of pro-labour politicians and activists into the 1955 election. And this brings us back to where we started. So this really brief sketch of David Marshall's life until the 1955 election reflects many of the themes that we have drawn out in our history of Singapore as a whole. He was a true son of Singapore, not just in being born here and loving this country, but also in his experience of colonialism, the discrimination he faced as a member of one of Singapore's smallest communities on the basis of his race and religion meant that from a young age he was keenly aware of injustice and inhumanity. He was first detained at age 6, and in every step of his schooling he experienced some major example of discrimination at CHIJ, at SJI, at St. Andrews, and at Raffles. He faced discrimination while working, as well as economic deprivation, and even approached starvation. Imagine a world where doctors won't give you treatment because you can't pay your bills, or a world where the government blatantly treats you differently because of your race, where your race affects where you work and how much you're paid and how you're treated, or a world where the government focuses entirely on economic success, where it justifies its rule entirely on economic indicators, disregarding the welfare and well-being of its people, where we're treated like economic digits instead of human beings. What kind of inhumane world is that? But that's what the colonial world was like. And Marshall struggled against it and kept struggling against discrimination in Singapore, then in London, then back in Singapore. He struggled against injustice, both on a personal level, on a community level, and then on a national level. He faced discrimination in the military, then faced deprivation and torture from the Japanese, and came out of it stronger and harder and more determined to make the world a better place. And so this background explains who Marshall is. He's a man who experiences injustice and discrimination. He's a man who knows what it's like to be poor, to be hungry and desperate. He knows what it's like to be discriminated against on the basis of your culture, ethnicity, religion. And because of this, he's a man who's highly motivated, a man with fire in his belly, a man of great personal moral conviction, a man of great intelligence and courage. And so after the war, he comes back to Singapore and he not only helps rebuild, but he takes up numerous causes. And like other Singaporeans, he realizes that the system is stacked against them all. And so in order to effectively create change, he reluctantly gets drawn into politics. Not because he wants power, not because he thinks he's the best person for the job, but because he wants to make a difference. So it is no surprise that I believe that he is the first and greatest of all of Singapore's leaders. Yes, you heard me right. There's no doubt in my mind that David Marshall is the greatest of Singapore's five leaders. Not the most accomplished, not the best, maybe not even the smartest, but the greatest. In terms of greatness, being a great man, David Marshall stands first. And indeed, of our five leaders, our five chief and prime ministers, he stands alone as being a truly great man. And next week, I'll explain why. Join me then. As always, if you have any questions, comments or feedback, please email me at thehistoryofsingapore@gmail.com or visit my webpage at thehistoryofsingapore.com. See you next week. This has been The History of Singapore, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.